Are you an accredited investor looking for a new opportunity to generate passive income and build the retirement of your dreams? Then elevate your investment game with Viking Capital, where wealth meets wisdom. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just starting out, Viking Capital can help guide you towards financial freedom through passive real estate investing. With strong and transparent underwriting, Viking identifies low-risk opportunities with the goal of preserving investor capital and maximizing long-term growth potential. And their accessible and responsive investor relations team will help you understand how each investment will impact your unique financial goals. With $800 million in assets acquired, more than $230 million in equity raised, and more than 5,000 units under management, Viking Capital is your path to early retirement. To learn about Viking Capital's latest investment opportunity, which is available for you right now, visit go.vikingcapllc.com/best. That's go.vikingcapllc.com/best to get started today. Did you know that within a decade, women will hold $30 trillion in investable assets? Yet somehow, only 19% of women reported feeling confident in selecting investments that align with their long-term goals. Our friends at InvestHer are out to change that. InvestHerCon is the number one premier conference for women in real estate, and it's happening June 2nd through the 4th in Austin, Texas. InvestHerCon is not just another real estate conference. It's a transformational experience focused on real estate investing, business strategies, and self-care tactics, all designed to help women take control of their financial futures. Gain the knowledge and skills you need to grow your portfolio and build a sustainable business, all while connecting with over 500 women who are playing at the same level. To learn more and to get your tickets, visit InvestHerCon.com today and use the code 100BESTEVER to get $100 off your ticket. That's InvestHer, HERCon.com, promo code 100BESTEVER to get $100 off your ticket. Quick disclaimer, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are provided for informational purposes only and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities or to make or consider any investment or course of action. For more information, go to bestevershow.com.
Welcome to the Best Ever Show, the world's longest running daily commercial real estate podcast. Our hosts interview commercial real estate experts every day to get you the best advice ever with none of the fluffy stuff.
Hello, Best Ever listeners, and welcome to the Best Real Estate Investing Advice Ever Show. I'm your host for today, Paul Mueller, and we're back today with another Best Ever Midweek News Brief. Usually, what we'll do here is run through some of the week's top CRE headlines for you, then bring in an expert guest to discuss our top story. But today, we're going to forego the headlines and jump right into our top story. There's plenty going on in CRE right now, so if you'd like to stay on top of the latest CRE headlines and also get other relevant CRE investing tips and advice, you can find it all in the Best Ever newsletter. We send it out once a week, and we pack it with as much relevant and informative content as we can to make sure you walk away a little bit more informed. Just go to bestevercre.com/access to subscribe, or click the link in the show notes. And now for today's top story. Look, it's no secret what's been happening in office real estate across the country since the pandemic. During COVID-19, as work from home became ingrained in the American economy, office values plummeted. If you've ever listened to this show, you've probably heard Ash Patel talk about office real estate and the opportunity that's on the horizon. Well, he's definitely not alone. With $117 billion in CRE office debt maturing in 2024 and a 20% vacancy rate, which is the highest in 40 years, investors with dry powder are preparing to capitalize. And it's not just the institutional investors who are ready to pounce. According to a recent piece in Commercial Observer, Chad Carpenter, founder of Revin Capital, and Ethan Penner, the CEO of Mosaic Real Estate Investors, recently launched a $1 billion publicly traded real estate investment trust to raise capital for distressed office opportunity. Today, joining me on the Best Ever Show, I have the journalist who researched and wrote that piece, which is titled The $1 Billion Question: Will the Money Raised for Distressed Office Be Successful? His name is Brian Paskus. Brian is a reporter and editor for Commercial Observer on the Commercial Real Estate beat. He's a trained political journalist who cut his teeth on the City Hall beat, and he's worked at CBS News and other outlets. Today, he'll take us inside his story and inside this wave of capital being raised for distressed office assets. Brian, thanks so much for joining us today. How are you?
Hello, Paul. How are you doing? Thank you very much for having me on here.
Yeah, I'm doing well also. We've talked via email about a couple of pieces that you've written recently, and I think we ended up choosing the right one to key in on, because obviously office is a pretty hot topic with all the distress and everything that's going on in that space. So I'm excited that you were able to put this piece together and that you're here with us to talk about it.
Absolutely. So looking forward to breaking down some of these complex topics in commercial real estate. I know we've been going back and forth for a while, and the holidays obviously got in the way with me coming on your show, but more than happy to come in here and talk about whatever you want to discuss to get to the heart of commercial real estate finance.
Definitely. And I want to start, Brian, I'm just going to read this one paragraph from the top of your piece, and then we can get right into it. So Chad Carpenter, the founder of Revin Capital, and Ethan Penner, the CEO of Mosaic Real Estate Investors, announced their launch of Revin Office REIT, a $1 billion publicly traded real estate investment trust solely devoted to providing office owners and hungry investors with bespoke capital for distressed office assets on either the debt or equity side of the fence. This is me speaking now. This is the latest in a small series of investors, either large investors coming to the table for these REITs or smaller investors pooling capital to really just sit by and wait for this distress to hit the fan and the opportunity to come about. So real quick, just give me the Cliff's Notes version of this piece, what it's about, why it was a topic that you guys chose to cover at this time.
Well, I guess the short answer is this piece examines some of the money that's been raised and the ambitions for that money and that capital to go into office distress. And by that, we mean there are billions of dollars worth of office properties across the United States that were financed at levels and under a certain assumptions that are no longer applicable because of COVID-19 and the change in behavior that so many millions of Americans have exhibited now for 4 years in regards to using office space. And because of that, that changing basis of the behavior of people and companies and firms and employees of how much they use office and where they want to use it and so on and so forth, the capital investments and the loans that were made to these office sponsors, the developers or the owners of office buildings, those no longer hold. So there's a ton of distress in that a lot of these loans that the sponsors have taken out to either develop or manage office properties, they can no longer afford them because they no longer have the same amount of tenant usage as they had previously. And because of that, the mortgages on these offices and the loans behind them, these need new capital injections, whether that's debt or equity. And you have opportunistic investment firms or individuals or REITs or whatnot, they are fundraising to raise money at the tune usually of $1 billion, if not more, to invest into these distressed capital stacks that make up the office loan in order to right the ship, so to speak. Because the value of office is no longer, for example, if an office building was worth $100 million and now it's only worth $60 million. Well, a lot of that equity on that loan was wiped out and they need to come at a new basis in order to continue to service the loan. And the lenders, of course, are involved in this. And there's a whole complex web of arrangements between the lenders, the sponsors, the borrowers, and now the new equity or debt injections of capital to make the office building itself and the loan behind it viable. I might have explained it in a little bit too technical terms, but that's the meat and potatoes here. I guess I'll just use really plain English. You got people in office buildings, they need new money, and they need fresh money in order to continue to operate their office buildings. That's what it comes down to.
So it's interesting, right? Because you mentioned the amount of office debt maturing in 2024. It's around $117 billion is what I'm seeing. And there's also a 20% vacancy rate, which is the highest in 40 years. So it's very obvious of the distress in the office sector. I don't think anybody's debating that. I guess the question that I have for you is, why is now the time that these institutional investors are pooling this capital? Why now?
Well, it's interesting. I think it goes back to how the article began. And when my editors had mentioned to me to examine some office distress, I had a conversation with Chad Carpenter and Ethan Penner, who have recently, early in the part of the year, formed a office REIT called Revin Capital, Revin Office REIT, that sole function is to raise money. Then they're going to become a publicly traded company. They're going to get money from, obviously, investors and mom and pops, for instance, as well. Big, small, whatever you want to call it. And they're going to use that money to invest and lend as well onto distressed office properties. They're going to be able to play all sorts of sides of the capital stack. And speaking with Chad Carpenter and Ethan Penner, the reason why is this happening now is because he brought it back to Carpenter, that is, Chad Carpenter brought it back to his experience in the early 1990s, when you had a similar resetting of basis with the value of office properties. A lot of offices were built in the mid to late 80s. Money was very easy in the go-go Reagan era. And after the savings and loan crisis occurred, you had basically a slow-burning financial crisis that took a few years to play itself out. But one of the things that was hit was the balance sheets of lenders. And of course, the people who borrowed the loans that lenders had made for a lot of this commercial real estate. So you had a whole lot of distressed office back then. Penner had invested in it. So had Carpenter. And they both recognized as well after the 2008 financial crisis that something very similar had happened with residential housing, where you had people take out a lot of money to buy houses they couldn't afford. When the bubble popped, a lot of those distressed residential properties were then up for grabs at a much lower cost than they had previously been loaned out on. So that's called opportunistic investing. That's when you put your money in, when the value of something that was valuable at a certain point 5 years ago, now 5 years later, you're getting that for 50%, 60% off. That's how a lot of these people make a lot of money, is they buy low and they sell high. So this is the same type of phenomenon that investors like Penner and Carpenter are seeing today with office property. Chad Carpenter said that he thinks 30% of office is just obsolete in terms of it's old, no one's going to use it, it's in bad parts of these American cities, and no matter what, because now you have 35% of the workforce that works from home or hybrid pretty regularly. I mean, here I'm having this interview for my own apartment today. Granted, it was a snowstorm in New York, but I go in maybe 3 or 4 days a week only. So you have a lot of Americans who are no longer going to the office like they used to. He recognizes this, but at the same time, the office is always going to be part of the American landscape. Not everyone wants to work from home 5 days a week. It drives you crazy. You want to get out there. You want to experience life. You want to see coworkers. You want to collaborate. And you want to be able to concentrate. Okay. You want to get away from your dog, your kids, whatever you want to call it. So there's still a use for office. And he believes that even when office loses some of its value, the sponsors behind these loans are going to need new capital to come in and allow them to continue operating them. Because lenders do not want to operate an office building. And maybe I'm anticipating another question here, but when you're JP Morgan Chase and you've loaned out $200 million on a big office building and that sponsor can no longer pay it because they've lost 40% of their tenancy, JP Morgan Chase does not have a group of people who know how to operate an office building. They're bankers. They're not property managers. They're not experts at the capital intensive elements of office operation. So they don't want you to hand back the keys. They want to work out a deal with you in order to do so. So what these opportunistic funds are doing is they're coming in, they're going to say, hey, we can lend you money on your loan. We can invest with you in either the debt or the equity side. And we can try to help you pay your loan as you go along. But in return, we want a very preferable part of the capital stack to make some nice return on this investment. And that's what's happening.
Yeah, Brian, it's interesting. You mentioned in there the age-old philosophy of buy low, sell high. Obviously, that's a core tenet of investing, right? It's a little bit less so in commercial real estate because of the value-add element and the fact that you can buy at the top of the market, continue to add value, repurpose your properties, whatever it is, and still have a worthwhile investment. So it's a little less common in terms of as being a core tenet in commercial real estate. But I'm more interested, obviously, you're buying low right now if you're buying office, right? A lot of distress is coming if it's not here already. The question I have is about the future. I agree with you that a lot of people are going to want office to be a part of their life. Not a lot of people are going to want to work from home full time. Office is always going to be a part of the American experience, the American landscape. But the fact that it's going to be so drastically different as we move forward, and I don't know that personally I've seen any indications of what that's really going to look like and where that dust is going to settle in terms of how prevalent that office space is going to be in some of these major markets. You're in New York City, obviously. That's a much different landscape than most of the rest of us are operating in, but it's still the same problem within these little silos across the country. So I guess my question for you is, when you talk to people like Chris and you talk to people like Ethan, what do they see the future of office being in terms of the place that it's going to have in our lives as Americans and where we go to work and how often we go to work?
Well, it's interesting. When I spoke with them about that, I think the question that comes up with that is, what type of risk are you taking when you decide to make this investment in an uncertain asset class, in an asset class where we don't necessarily know how many Americans are going to be using it going forward, especially as demographics change, baby boomers die out, Gen X gets older, millennials get older, and Gen Z, who was raised with a cell phone glued to their eyes and a computer basically attached to their brains, are these people familiar with interacting in an office space and using it? And then you have millions of American graduates who came of age during COVID, where for a four-year period, they were often told to work from home, don't come in, be virtual, be mobile, be hybrid. So that's a type of risk that comes out of investing in the asset class right now, just because we don't know where it's going. And two things I think came up in response to that. The first one was that office is distressed right now, and you've had a lot of people be negative about office, and there's certain good reason to. There is a ton of office that is no longer needed. You drive along a lot of American highways, the office space that's not in central business districts, that's along the road, the classic six-story glass office building, no one's going to want to work there. No one's going to want to go into those places. That's a bad investment. But a One Vanderbilt next to Grand Central Station, that's 100 stories tall, Class A office space, very nice, very new. People want to go to work there. That's the type of office building where you're going to get up in the morning and look forward to doing that. So it depends. It depends on neighborhoods. It depends on location. It depends on the underlying assumptions behind the sponsors have done with the property. But they also point out that offices a lot of times tied to politics, because offices, for better or worse, define the skylines of American cities and the downtowns. When we talk about the skyline of Cincinnati or Austin, Texas, these aren't like the biggest skylines, but when you look at them, the tallest buildings there are usually going to be office buildings. And the thing is, you don't know what's going to happen to a downtown, even in Los Angeles, downtown Los Angeles. A lot of Class A office buildings were built that are not being used as much as they have been previously. Brookfield's had all sorts of issues with their office buildings there. You don't know what's going to happen. And this is a long way of saying it in terms of the politics around the cities. That is something that came up with these developers, in that they're kind of at the mercy of the local political choices made that impact public safety. Because when public safety gets difficult and it worries folks, you're not going to have anyone coming to the office, no matter if you're at One Vanderbilt in Midtown New York, if people are worried about crime. So that's the biggest concern that these developers and these sponsors and these investors have about future office usage. It's not so much whether people come back to work, because it seems that we've plateaued at around one third. About 33% of people are going to be hybrid, and that's how it is. But then everyone else, that 66%, is pretty used to coming in a lot, if not 3 or 4 days a week. No one comes in on Fridays, it seems. And that's fine. That's probably good for the country in the long run to have more time with your family. But the main thing that concerns these developers is what happens around central business districts with public safety, because nothing will impact the office investment worse than concerns about high crime.
You're obviously in New York, Brian, and you just mentioned Los Angeles. Obviously, what's happening in San Francisco with the office space and really just with commercial real estate in general there, I think everybody's familiar with that landscape. I'm interested, when you talk to people like Chris and Ethan and maybe some of these others, did you get any indication of where they're looking to invest? Are they looking to invest in these major LA, New York, San Francisco markets? Or are they looking at these office spaces in Cincinnati, Tampa, some of those mid-markets?
I think they're holding their cards close to their vest right now because they're in the process of fundraising.
Right.
SL Green recently announced its intention to invest $1 billion in New York City specific office. Scott Reckler's RXR announced its own $1 billion fundraising venture for, I think, New York office space as well. So New York's obviously a play because it is like the top real estate environment in the United States. But I spoke with Wu-Kang Cho, who's an investor based in Florida and West Palm Beach and also Washington, D.C. And he's playing in the South. He raised a $500 million vehicle last year for distressed office. He's so far only invested $60 million into a property in Dallas. And he told me he's taking a very conservative approach. They're really going to wait and see. It seems that they're market agnostic. If there's a good deal out there, they'll jump on it. And the markets I think one should look at is where is there going to be the most distress? And obviously Los Angeles is going to have quite a bit, but it's unclear. California, like San Francisco, Los Angeles, just the general culture of that state, it seems that it's been harder to get folks, especially in the tech sphere, especially with the weather, to come back to the office full time in comparison to New York, living here, we are seeing a pretty good amount of people come back 3 to 4 days a week. That said, Washington, D.C., I think is going to be a prime target for distressed investing because so much of that office space is used by the federal government. And under President Biden, it's been a long time for federal employees to come back. And that's something I think that's not fully appreciated right now, in that the Biden administration did not force their employees to come back. They took office, obviously, in January 2021 when the pandemic was still raging. It was at a bad point, obviously. The vaccines hadn't even been out yet. So I think that if we look back on a consequential decision the administration will have made in its first term, that's going to be one of them, because D.C. is a ghost town. We have a reporter, Keith Loria, who's stationed in D.C., and he writes about it often. And I went to college in D.C. I visit multiple times a year. You walk around, it's not the same city. No one is around downtown. And this is our nation's capital. It's a beautiful city. It's as pretty as Paris. And yet no one's coming back in. So you're going to have a lot of issues with those loans on these D.C. office buildings. And I think that's going to be a prime target for distressed investing.
We'll get back to the show. But first, some sponsors I'm confident you'll find value in learning more about. A 1031 exchange is one of the greatest tools to build your real estate portfolio. But before you sell your next investment property, if you want to save thousands in capital gains taxes, please give our friends at 1031 Pros a call. Whether you're an individual investor, title company, or real estate agent, 1031 Pros is ready to help you or your clients with their 1031 exchange needs. With over 30 years of experience, 1031 Pros specializes in various types of exchanges like delayed, simultaneous, reverse, and improvement exchanges in all 50 states, all while ensuring your transaction is fast, reliable, transparent, and secure. 1031 Pros has handled over 20,000 audit-free exchanges, and right now, best ever listeners can get $250 off any exchange by visiting my1031pros.com/best ever. That's my1031pros.com/best ever to get $250 off today. Have you heard that Mint, the popular personal finance app, is shutting down? If you use Mint, that's bad news. The good news is that there's an even better alternative, Monarch Money. Monarch gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. Create custom budgets, set goals, and collaborate with others. And now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/best ever. Most personal finance apps are clunky and cluttered with ads. Monarch is different. Its intuitive design makes setup, customization, and everyday use simple and easy. Monarch is also the most customizable budgeting app available. You can change your dashboard layout, create custom budgets and notifications, and even invite your partner, accountant, or financial advisor to have a joint view of your finances at no extra cost. Once you try Monarch for yourself, you'll understand why it was named 2024's best budgeting app by the Wall Street Journal. And right now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/best ever. That's monarchmoney.com/best ever for your extended 30-day free trial.
Brian, I'm really interested, especially since you mentioned what's happening in D.C. A lot of commuters in D.C., right? A lot of people who live in Alexandria and Maryland or Virginia across the river who commute into D.C. So those longer commute times, I'm sure, look at someplace like New York City, you're a subway ride away usually. And that's kind of a part of the New York experience, right? Like getting on the subway, going to work every day, walking down the street, experiencing the culture, experiencing the people, less so in LA and San Francisco, like you mentioned. Mm-hmm. But when you talk about DC or some of these other places, I'm interested. I'm looking at some stats here. You know, there's been as much as 65% discounts off of the original values of some of the office spaces in some of these big cities that were purchased pre-pandemic. Because the values have dropped so drastically, obviously the equity's gone, so the lenders have to take a markdown. We've been over that. We all understand that. But with the uncertainty in the office sector in general, what's the plan for a lot of these buildings? Are these investors targeting these for conversions in some cases, or is the plan to hold them as traditional office assets?
Well, conversions are going to be a part of the conversation, but that's going to be done on a case-by-case basis. Office conversion into residential is extremely difficult to do. And I'll tell you the reason why it's so hard. I've had conversations with developers. For any residential building, you're going to need to build a lot of apartments. And in every apartment, you're going to want to have one or two, sometimes three bathrooms. A bathroom is contingent on the plumbing system. An office building's plumbing system was set up so that there's only a couple of bathrooms on every floor, and they're situated usually in the center of the building. So the piping runs all the way through, and that's what people use for their bathrooms. It's the same floor plan on every building. That is incredibly difficult to change if you're trying to convert an office building into a residential building and move the piping system around to make these good-looking apartments have certain layouts that people will actually rent at high levels in order to make back your money. So it's extremely cost-intensive and hard to do to convert an office building into a residential building, especially if it's older. Also, there's an issue with windows. A lot of these office buildings are glass towers that the windows don't open. So in most American cities, there's no zoning code in the world that will allow you to have a residential building that doesn't allow you to have open windows. It has to do with fire hazard stuff. It has to do with safety and even just general quality of life. So a lot of times it's impractical to convert an office building into a residential building. That being said, where there is a amount of value is on the land. So I think Chad Carpenter said he thinks 15% of office buildings will be demolished. And that makes sense. And hopefully they'll be rebuilt as residential housing, considering our country needs so much residential housing. There's obviously demand for people to live. Granted, most Americans would like to own their home, but we don't live in a perfect world. And we live in an economy that's been turned upside down by a variety of forces. And I've written about this. More people are going to be renting in the future. And one of the ways we could alleviate the housing crisis is through construction of multifamily apartments, either on the land that obsolete office used to use, or in the case where it does pencil, through conversions. New York has shown an interesting path forward because after 9/11, the downtown, the financial district where the World Trade Centers were, that was the first part of Manhattan that was ever built up. It's the southern tip of the island. It's near the Statue of Liberty. So the earliest office buildings in America, built in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, those classic Great Depression Art Deco structures like 70 Pine, 40 Wall Street, the Woolworth Building at 233 Broadway, and there's many, many more. These buildings were constructed as the original office towers. But when businesses moved out of the financial district after 9/11, that neighborhood was a ghost town. So companies did not want to work there. So what they did do was they converted all these old 1930s style office buildings into residences. Now, the reason that worked was because the floor plans back then in the mid-20th century were almost set up like apartments for offices. That's like how it was. And so it actually tended to work perfectly for conversions. But New York has shown that it's possible to reinvent a large central business district into what it is today. Much of the financial district is residences. There's still a bunch of businesses down there. Obviously, the stock exchange is down there. It's where Wall Street is. But there is a path forward. So some of them will be converted. Some might not. Some will be demolished. But that's how they view it. And then also, others will continue to chug along. And that's where this new capital infusions will come in handy.
Yeah. In a past life, when I worked in New York City for a small company, our office felt more like the apartment in Friends than it did any of the apartments that you see now with the floor-to-ceiling glass windows and the high-rises. I could definitely see how, especially on the southern side of the island, how that could be the case.
Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of weird buildings in New York. Trust me, I've been inside them. So that's one of the charms and the curses of the city.
With all these institutional investors and these people who are raising capital to take advantage of this office distress, aside from getting involved as a part of these funds and a part of these REITs, what does this mean for the smaller investors who are interested in office space?
Well, I think the way in for a smaller investor would be through a publicly traded REIT. You could buy in there. That's kind of your only option because all this other distressed fundraising for investment, this is done through the heavy hitters, private equity, debt funds, pension funds, family offices, billionaires. It's an unfortunate element of capitalism, but there's a whole environment of private equity money and investment money that just multiplies on itself and invests in various asset classes throughout our country. And it basically regenerates on itself and it regenerates its own returns for a very small group of Americans and businesses. There is a 1% and it exists. And that's where this fundraising comes in. And that's what it does. Literally, this is private equity 101. This is debt funds 101. It just consistently fundraises, invests, makes certain returns, and does it all over again. So I don't really have a good answer in terms of how mom and pops can get in besides the public spaces of the various indexes out there for them. And I think a REIT like Penner and Carpenter's or Revan Office REIT is one of them. Of course, you could buy shares of mortgage REITs that are publicly traded. That's probably the best bet. But unfortunately, a lot of the killings that are going to be made in office investment are going to go to those big dogs who already have control of the pot.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a huge opportunity for passive investors, maybe less so for the active investors and the GPs who are trying to raise capital on their own.
Yeah, it's going to cost a lot to get in on any basis into an office property because the loans are normally so big. These are normally north of $100 million loans, depending on the property.
And Brian, I think the last thing here before we get you out of here is I love to ask this question anytime I have a journalist on who's out on the ground covering these topics and turning over stones and is digging up this information, these muckrakers. What's the most interesting revelation that you had while researching this piece and while interviewing for this piece?
Most interesting revelation? Let me think about that. That's a good question. I think I mentioned this earlier. I liked hearing from Chad Carpenter discussing the correlations between some of the down cycles that we experienced in the early 1990s with office and then during the 08 financial crisis in terms of distressed investing. I think for me, when I heard that, I said to myself, if I had $500 million to my name, aside from giving a good portion of that away to charity, I would probably want to invest in distressed real estate. I think that would be a smart move to do because it can only go up. People always need to live places. And as economic cycles occur, there's always a value drop in these things. That is the time to buy, is buy low. So for me, hearing from some of these buccaneering entrepreneurs, these capitalists on how they made their money and what they did and getting the inside scoop, you learned some things and it made sense to me. And it makes sense to me now that office does seem to be a generational investment with some properties. Some people are going to get burnt. Some of these investments are going to go south because of factors that go beyond what they can plan, whether it's environmental or political, but others will go north. So the big revelation to me, the most interesting thing I learned, it might seem obvious to people, but I'm only a journalist, I'm not an investor, is buying low is truly the smartest thing to do.
Brian, I love it. Thank you so much for your hard work on putting this piece together. As a quasi-journalist myself, I understand what it takes to go out there and, like I said, turn over those stones and contact these people and really put together a really thoughtful piece. So I'm appreciative that you did that. I really enjoy reading it. For those of you who are listening who want to read this, the link will be in the show notes. We'll also be sharing it on social media along with this episode. Real quick, before we jump off, Brian, tell people how they can find you and how they can follow your work.
You could just Google my name and go to commercialobserver.com. All my articles are archived. And subscribe to Commercial Observer. We have a wonderful print magazine we put out once a week. It's truly phenomenal, the depth of our coverage and the length of our stories. You're not getting pitter-patter journalism that's only 500 words. You're getting really meaty pieces that explain how our economy works, how you can make money off of it, and how you can better understand the world of commercial real estate and commercial real estate finance. So subscribe to Commercial Observer, and you can thank me later.
Great, Brian. I love that. Thank you again for joining us today and for all the work that you do. And hopefully we'll get the opportunity to connect again soon when you do another one of these great pieces.
Absolutely, Paul. Thank you for having me on your podcast. I'm happy to come back. Thank you.
And that's our show for today. If you want to read more about the billions being raised to take advantage of distressed office assets, click the link in the show notes. In the meantime, as always, thanks again, best of listeners. We really appreciate you. And remember, if you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a 5-star review. Share it with someone you think could find some value in it. Also, follow, subscribe, and have a best ever day.
Hi, best ever listeners. Joe Fairless here again. And one last thing before you go, would you like to receive a short weekly email with proven tips from experienced investors, free tools and resources, and a roundup of the week's most relevant news and best ever content? Well, if so, join the community of nearly 15,000 commercial real estate passive and active investors who receive the best ever newsletter. Just go to bestevercre.com/access and you'll get the very next one. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And as always, thank you for listening and have a best ever day.